All right, let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you so much for this day. I thank you for a Sunday to gather here in your house to be refreshed through fellowship with fellow believers, through humbling ourselves before your word, through being encouraged and challenged for what you would have for us to hear this week. I pray that this morning that you would allow our minds to rest in you, as we look at your word and dwell on what it would have for each one of us individually. I pray that you would guide my words, keep me focused, and allow me to be an accurate voice for you. I pray all this in your name. Amen. All right, so as Tim just read, we are looking at 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 9 through 12. Pretty short section this week, but it does have a lot of really good points that Paul wanted to bring to the Thessalonians. And what's happening here, basically continuing from where Caleb was speaking last week, you had a lot of, in the first three chapters, of Paul basically saying, hey, you remember that time that I was there and the things that we did, and basically just continuing to build rapport with the Thessalonian church because he wasn't there for very long. And now you have, at the end here, you have a lot of instructions that he's giving. So last week, Caleb spoke on his exhortations regarding sexual purity, and now this week, we have a very short section on brotherly love. And when I first was, I just briefly read through this section just kind of to get my mind focusing on it throughout the week. When I first glanced through it, I'm like, oh, awesome, I just read a book on this. There's a great chapter that I want to use as like a really extended illustration on it. And then the more I studied it, and I'm like, that's not where Paul's going. So that ruined that plan. But I was actually really excited about where he went with his instructions regarding brotherly love. It's not normally where you would expect a section on love to go. But I really like just digging into it and seeing what he had to say to the Thessalonian churches and why he wrote it this way. So I hope that you'll be able to glean some of the research I was able to do and seeing what Paul was saying here. So let's start in verse chapter 9. Now concerning brotherly love. You have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves have been taught by God to love one another. For that indeed is what you are doing to all the brothers throughout Macedonia. So he starts here by introducing a new topic. Basically that's what the now concerning, and then later in 13 you have, but we do not want you to be uninformed. He's usually pretty obvious about when he's introducing a new topic, which is kind of nice for Paul, especially for Caleb and I for sermon prep. It's like, oh, hey, here's a good place to split. We should probably do a sermon starting in 13 and one starting in 9. So Paul here opens up a new section on brotherly love, and he right away just acknowledges that you've asked me about this, which, by the way, is probably why he's addressing certain topics, is either the Thessalonians wrote to him about it or he heard about something in their church. He's like, you wrote me about this, but honestly, you guys don't really need me to tell you much about this because you're doing it really well. In fact, so well that your reputation is spreading all throughout your region and even beyond, which is a really cool thing for Paul to be able to say of such a young church. Even in the short time they'd been around, their love was so evident that the entire region knew about it, which is also really cool if you look into the history and the geography of what's going on in that area of the world. Because Thessalonica is actually the capital of the province of Macedonia. So I guess in a way you could think of it like a state, like if Macedonia is a state, Thessalonica is the capital. And not only that, but Thessalonica was known as the mother of that province because it was a geographic hub and also an economic hub. I feel like I'm echoing a lot. All right. Anyways, I'll just talk quieter. Cool. All right, thank you. So this city had become known as the mother, and it took care of all of the cities around it. And what's really cool is that the church had claimed that for themselves as well, because they were working on being the mother to all the churches in the area around them, and they even took it a step further than the city, because Thessalonica was known as the mother of the towns in the immediate area, and the church had claimed it even farther and was becoming known as like a mother church to even the surrounding regions beyond Macedonia. So it's really cool just how the church had claimed that for themselves. And Paul's acknowledging that there and saying, guys, look, you're doing really good at this, and I just want to first commend you for that. And then he also mentions again that it's being all the brothers throughout Macedonia. So their love had been known, and probably specifically what he's referring to here in their love being spread and them kind of being the mother church to a lot of other churches is that they were a very generous church, which is also surprising because the churches here in Macedonia, specifically Thessalonica, later in 2 Corinthians, Paul actually says that they're a very poor region, which is interesting because Thessalonica and other Macedonian churches were known as extremely generous churches, even in their poverty. And probably what's being referred to with the love that's being spread around is there might have been like missionaries going out and church members going out to different churches, but a lot of what Thessalonica was doing was supporting movements that were happening in surrounding villages. And when they heard of a need, they pulled together to help that need. So there's a lot of generosity going on from this church. So he first starts by saying that you guys are doing really well in this area. But then he goes on to say that we urge you, brothers, to do this more and more, which is an incredibly vague instruction. That's how he starts. And what you actually have going on in the rest of these verses is you have four grammatically parallel commands that are given. You have urge you to do this more and more, and then aspire to live, mind your own affairs, work your own hands. But what I think is going on here is he starts incredibly vague and just says, do this more and more. And then the next three commands that happen, he's developing how they can love more and more. Which again is really interesting where he takes his starting point of brotherly love and where he goes to next. Because it's not normally what we would think of when we just think of, okay, how do you tell people how to exercise brotherly love? Which actually, before I go any further, something really cool about the fact that he's talking about brotherly love. This specific phrase, brotherly love, it was actually only ever used outside of the Bible, outside of Paul, mostly. It was only ever used in the context of love within a nuclear family or extended family, like a physical family. But Paul purposefully uses that word to the church family. And he's purposely drawing their attention and acknowledging that they're doing this well, saying that you guys are living and loving like a family. And that's how it's supposed to be. The church is a family, and you guys are doing that, and I want you to do it more and more, and I'm going to show you how to do that. So after that, we have three ways, basically, that they can improve and increase their love to love more and more. And in the rest of the verses, we see, in starting in 11, to aspire to live quietly, to mind your own affairs, and to work with your hands, as we instructed you, so that you may walk properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one. So in 11, we have three brief commands of how they can improve their love or how they can increase their love. Aspire to live quietly, mind your own affairs, and work with your own hands. Which, again, isn't necessarily where we'd always feel like brotherly love would go. It's like, okay, love more and more and more. How do you do that? Go live quietly. Go work. Wait, what? Like, that's not where most places in the Bible go, or like most preachers or most teachings go when they're like, all right, go love. Go show brotherly love to those inside and outside the church. All right, how do we do that? Go work. Go mind your own business. Go live quietly. Okay. Cool. How does that help? What makes this so applicable to the Thessalonians is why he went here. Why would he, when talking about brotherly love, go straight to live quietly, mind your own affairs, work with your own hands? There are a few reasons why he went specifically to these commands. First and foremost, he wanted the church to not be known as a contentious, disruptive group of people. Why would that be important? Is it easy to be lights in the world and spread the gospel if your reputation is trashed? if you're known as a group of troublemakers who just get involved with things to shake it up and just are always disruptive and kind of shoving their beliefs in your face, it's really hard to then follow that up with trying to show the love of God and be generous and share the gospel. So what's happening, and what I'm going to dig into a little bit more specifically with some specific things he's probably talking about, is that first and foremost, he's worried about the reputation of the church for the sake of spreading the gospel. But at the same time, we see that he's not worried about the reputation of the church so much that he's saying, compromise the gospel. That's not Paul. But he's making sure that as they're living their lives, as they're working, as they're being involved with economics, with the society, with politics, as they're involved in all those things, nothing that they're doing is harming their ability to spread the gospel, unless they absolutely need to defy the government for a specific reason, which we see Paul and the other apostles doing when needed. So that's what his overarching goal is. Some specific things he's probably talking about are seen later in 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians. In 1 Thessalonians, he's going to later talk about, and I'm not going to dig too deep into it because we are going to preach on it later, but in 5:12-13, he says, "We ask you, brothers, to respect those who labor among you and who are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Be at peace among yourselves." So that's in 1 Thessalonians 5:12-13. I think he purposely throws in that "and admonish you" for a reason. Because possibly what's going on in this church is you have leaders, potentially even young leaders like Timothy coming in and saying stuff to them, who's pretty young. You have leaders that are exhorting people within the church, and potentially these church members are not receiving that very well. They're being instructed and exhorted to live better lives, to be more like God, and they're not receiving it very well. So first thing he's probably mentioning or talking about is their relationship with the leaders within their church, or even just more godly men and women who are encouraging them and instructing them. And he's challenging them to not be disruptive or contentious or to be gossipers or backbiters within your own church, and especially to your leaders, who are trying to make you look more like God. So what he gets to in later in chapter 5, and he's probably alluding to here as well, is that they are to respect their leadership even when they admonish them and to love them, which, by the way, is what you're supposed to do to every Christian, whether or not they're a leader. Because all Christians, as a Christian family, we're called to encourage and exhort each other and to push each other to look more like God. So if any Christian is exhorting you to look more like God, I would hope that we're each learning to respect that fellow Christian and to love them and to at least think about what they're calling us towards. Also, specifically regarding leadership, I think one thing that would tie in very well with what he's saying and what he's going to be going into later in chapter 5, if you have suggestions for changes or something that you need to confront those in leadership about, do you do so in a respecting, loving way? Which, again, is how you should treat any Christian. So that's probably the first thing that he's talking about. Another thing is something that's referred to, again, later in chapter 5, but also more specifically in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, and that is, don't be a busybody. Because when he's talking about being known as people who are disruptive and contentious, one thing that this church seems to have a few people, and we don't know how many, but it's either enough people or a few people who are doing this enough that Paul feels the need to write about it in 1 Thessalonians and again in more detail in 2 Thessalonians. And what's happening here is you have people who are busybodies or meddlers or gossipers or however you want to think of them that probably these people, and we'll get into this more later, but probably these people are people who are kind of loafers and have the ability to work but don't want to work, so they just kind of live on other people's dime, and then with their free time, they end up trying to like meddle into other people's business and cause disruptions for no reason. So he's saying, don't do that. Don't be known as people who do that. And I think why Paul is so concerned about this issue here in 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians is, again, the ability to spread the gospel. If you're known as people who are petty like that, who are disruptive like that, who are contentious like that, and who potentially even, like, if people told these people stuff, they would go spread it around in rumors. Like, if that's your reputation, who's going to want to listen to the gospel from you? Who's going to want to receive the love of God that you're trying to give them? And also, later on, we'll see this more again in the call to work. But I think Paul here is very aware of the axiom that the idle mind is the devil's workshop. And we're going to see this later in the call to work. He's like, okay, all of this free time that you're giving yourself that you really have no right to have because you have the ability to work and you're just loafing around, like, you're using that idle time for the wrong purpose. Which, again, isn't to say that all idle and downtime is bad, but we're going to see later that these were people that had the ability to work and were choosing not to work and were misusing all of the free time that that gave them. So we see the call to respect others and respect leadership, and we see the call to not be a busybody. Probably another thing that was very applicable to this group is that be careful of your political activism. And that would be important to this group specifically because Thessalonica, just like pretty much everywhere else in Rome, because Rome is kind of built in part on this concept, is that in Thessalonica you have a lot of the patron-client relationship. And basically what that means is that you have a more wealthy person, the patron, who supports a less wealthy or a less popular or whatever person who isn't working. The patron supports them, and the client, who is the one being supported, a lot of times uses that support for political or social or whatever agendas. So you had a lot of that going on in Thessalonica, just like everywhere else, and potentially you had also that setup being used even within the church itself, more wealthy Christians being used to support less wealthy Christians. So Paul is kind of purposely taking a jab at this lifestyle, because one, if you think about it, in Rome, which is led by an emperor who kind of, no matter how much of a political activism you have, you're probably not going to change his mind too much. Also, you have Rome, which is biased against Christianity, and then you have these Christians purposely placing themselves in dependence on patrons potentially outside of the church who are biased against the church. Like, just think of how quickly that situation gets really awkward for those in the church and how potentially damaging and dangerous that situation becomes. And Paul is purposely sliding in a command against this type of lifestyle, and specifically with the third command saying, work with your own hands, basically saying, take yourself out of that situation. Like, that's not a good situation to be in this country with this political setup that we have. So he's purposely talking against the patron-client relationship. And part of this is that, again, it's always coming back to the ability to spread the gospel. Because not only is it unwise to be in this type of situation, but also potentially there were people who were using this political activism to cause disruption and to become known as people who are causing divisions and just making unwise choices in the public sphere. And Paul again says, why are you putting yourself in that situation where what you are doing is harming the ability of the church to spread the gospel? So what he's getting at in part here is to avoid unnecessary conflict with the authorities so as to be able to spread the gospel and God's love. And this is, again, especially in his context, because the political system was not set up for them to be able to be involved in politics and fight for Christian rights in a peaceful way. They didn't have as many peaceful avenues as we have. They didn't have as many rights to protest and petition and everything that we do in our country. We're blessed to have many more avenues of how we can be involved in politics and not damage a Christian reputation and not damage the reputation of the church. But what he's getting at here is that rather than trying to be involved in politics in what's essentially a losing war with how everything's set up, The primary call to Christians is to change the lives of individuals within the society through the spread of the gospel, not to change the society itself, or specifically the government itself. And that's specifically what Paul is trying to drive home here. He's like, rather than spending your time on this losing battle of changing the government, which is part of the fallen world, which, by the way, we don't have a good setup for you guys to even be able to really change it very effectively, rather than wasting your time here, why don't you focus on changing the lives of individuals who make up the government? And then maybe the more the gospel spreads, maybe the government actually could change. Now, obviously, that's not saying that, like, that's we spread the gospel to change government. That's not the point. But our primary call as Christians is to spread the gospel, not to change government. That's what Paul's getting at. And again, I don't want the historical cultural context of that to come across to us that it means that we can do nothing here in our context and we shouldn't be involved in politics at all. It's a much different context to which he's speaking. The Roman political system is much different than the American political system that we're blessed with. In America, again, we're blessed with many more avenues of participation and petition and protest and everything like that that can be done in a way which won't harm the reputation of the person or of the church. Now, again, that's not to say that, like, even if you do it well, that it won't potentially. But there's more of a probability that you won't. But if how we involve ourselves in politics, whether it's through an official role, an office, anything like that, or how we even comment on people's posts on Facebook or what we tweet about, if how we are involved in politics starts to damage our ability to spread the gospel, to show the love of God, we really need to pause and consider what is more important to us at that point. If we're willing to be involved in politics in a way that is damaging the reputation of us as a Christian or as a church and our ability to spread the gospel, then in a sense, what we're doing at that point is saying that politics is more important to us than the kingdom of God. And that's a problem. And it also means that if we struggle to maintain even just a good attitude, like whatever level you're involved with, even if it's the littlest thing is like what you post on Facebook and the comments you put on Facebook, if even just something little as that puts you in a position where you know you struggle to maintain a good attitude, to maintain purity of speech, to be seen as a salt and light in the midst of whatever is happening, if you know that's a struggle for you, then you should really be careful about putting yourself in that situation. And that's more what he's getting at here is, does your involvement in politics or whatever it is, does your involvement in something harm your ability to spread the gospel? So he has a lot to say there about political activism, especially in that context. And then specifically looking at the last command of work with your hands as we instructed you. This is, again, tied to the patron-client relationship. And he's speaking against people who can work but aren't working and are purposely putting themselves in potentially awkward or dangerous situations of dependence on especially people outside of the church. So he exhorts them basically to earn your own living and support yourself. Which, by the way, kind of sidebar on this one before I dig into it too much. As I was looking into this one, we are incredibly blessed with a church of hard workers. So like, I want to just take a second just to commend everyone here. Like, when he talks about earning your own living and and being independent and seeing work as an opportunity to glorify God and to honor him through it, I feel like we have so many good examples of that in this church. So I don't want you to hear what I'm about to say as in the people in this church don't work hard enough and you need to start working harder. I feel like if anything, we struggle with the opposite extreme of working too much. But Paul here wants to give this last command, again, under the umbrella of brotherly love, to earn your own living. Possibly, besides from the patron-client relationship, possibly this is a warning against those who are using the imminent coming of Christ as an excuse to stop working. That's where many commentators go with what he's talking about here. And why they would go there is because the very next section of this letter talks about the second coming of the Lord, and it is a very consistent theme throughout 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. So possibly what's happening in the church is that you have people who are thinking about eschatology and thinking about the coming of the Lord and saying, well, if he could come any moment, then why am I working? Like, there are so many other things I should be doing. And Paul, who either ahead of time or even while he was there kind of figured out this would be a problem, set them an example. And it says here, work with your hands as we instructed you. He instructed them through word and also through his life. While he was there as a missionary, which is, again, where many Christians who feel bad about even working, if Christ is going to come, if his coming is imminent, they're like, well, we should just be out spreading the gospel. Well, Paul, even while he's evangelizing and doing his missionary work and spreading the gospel, he was a tent maker, supporting himself. And he did that purposely as an example to the church and said, yes, I firmly believe that Christ is going to come soon, but I work. Work itself is not bad. It's not distracting you from how you can glorify God. Adam was placed in the garden and told to work and to keep the garden before the curse. Work itself is good. It's part of how we were created in the image of God and can glorify him. It also gives us an opportunity to be a light and a testimony in spheres that we potentially would not have without our employment. And also another very large part of why he is specifically talking about earning your own living is going back to the first part of this section here. Remember how, as far as brotherly love, they were doing so well. They're known as those who are spreading love and generosity throughout the region and even abroad. Well, what happens when you have people within the church who can work but don't work and rely on support from those within the church? You have the church doing help and financial ministry to those within itself that don't actually need it. They're just not working. What does that do to your ability to be generous to those who actually need support? Your generosity is capped to the amount that you have that is above what you're already giving to those within yourself. So getting back to the, I urge you to do this more and more, he's like, hey, if you guys want to be even more generous, then stop loafing. If you have the ability to work, work. Be independent. Don't take resources away from yourself that you really don't have a right to be taking. If you have any ability at all to work, to support yourself, do that. And through that, you will have more resources freed up to be more generous to the churches surrounding you and even abroad. So what's amazing here, and something that we don't tend to usually think of when we think of work and earning our living and being independent, he calls the church to work as a labor of love and generosity. And I just think that's such a cool view of our own personal work, of our employment, of what we do with our life, whatever type of work we find ourselves in. Our work every day, in and out, the amount of work that we put into our job is our way of showing brotherly love, of putting ourselves in a place where we can be generous to others. We're working for the sake of others. When I realized that and saw the power of how he was going, or how he was wording this to go there with this passage, I just had to take a moment to pause and just be amazed by that, because that's such a cool way to view our work, and it gives you so much more motivation for, even if like it's a Wednesday and you're in the middle of the grind of a crazy week, you can just pause and remind yourself that this is how I glorify and honor God, and how I show love to my brother, and how I enable the church and myself to be more generous. So he calls the church to live quietly, mind their own affairs, and to work with their hands. And then in 12, he wraps it all up, so that you may walk properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one. So the point of these commands that he's been giving them in these last couple of verses was that the church would have a good reputation to those outside the church and within the church, and it would be self-sustaining so that it could spread the gospel more and more, and it could show brotherly love through generosity more and more. That's the point of living quietly, of minding your own affairs, and of earning your living, so that your reputation is maintained for the sake of spreading the gospel. So the question for us, well, two questions for us from this text. First question, what is the reputation of our church within this community? Because again, the main point of what Paul is getting at in this text is your reputation one that enables you to spread the gospel? Are we a church known for brotherly love? Are we a church known for generosity? Are we a church that is not seen as a leech on the community, but a source of generosity to the community? Because what was happening in Thessalonica is you had a church that was being a consumer of the economy rather than a benefactor to it. And Paul said that's not the position you want to be in as a church, because that damages your reputation to those around you that you want the ability to show love to and spread the gospel to. So what is the reputation of the church within the community? And also, because the church is built of individual people, what is your reputation as an individual within your community? Whether your community is here, this church, the town of Jordan, whatever town you live in, your coworkers, your internet friends, whatever your community is, what is your reputation? If there's anything that you are doing in whatever sphere of work or political views or opinions or whatever it is, if there's something that's damaging your reputation and your ability to spread the gospel, are you willing to pause and examine yourself and to change? Again, not calling you to a change that would be a compromise of the gospel. Paul never compromises the integrity of the gospel and the truth that needs to be communicated for the gospel to be heard. But if there's just something about how you're doing something, maybe it's you struggle to maintain a good attitude and a good testimony and talking about a certain topic or whatever, if there's something that's damaging your ability to spread the gospel, are you willing to see that and to change? So what is the reputation of our church and of you as an individual? Is your ability to show the love of God and to spread the gospel more important to you than whatever it is that you're doing, saying, or thinking that is damaging that reputation? Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you so much for this text. I thank you for the reminder from Paul to watch ourselves, to seek to maintain a good reputation as a church and as individuals, so that we can spread your love and the gospel. I pray that in every avenue and area of our lives that we would pause to consider this, that we would show that being your light in the world is the most important thing to us, and that everything that we do, as much as it is humanly possible and as much as doesn't violate your word, that we maintain a good reputation with those around us, and that we are known as exemplary workers, citizens, Christians, fathers, mothers, brothers, sons, students, whatever role we find ourselves in, that we do so in a way that enables us to be salt and light in the world, just like we're called to be. I pray all this in your name. Amen.